Okay, so I guess we should get going. So welcome to Perimeter Institute. My name is Richard Epp. I'm a member of the outreach team here. And in case you don't know, that's a black hole. And so welcome to Perimeter Institute's Black Hole Science Cafe. So the idea of these sessions is to introduce you to some of the wonders and mysteries of our amazing universe. And to get you sort of interested in the amazing and exciting research being done at the cutting edge of knowledge. Okay, so the title for our session today is The World as a Hologram. That's a question. Okay, so let me just begin by saying that the universe is deeply mysterious. And this question is tied closely to one of the deepest mysteries of all, which is, how is it possible for our universe to exist? Okay, so for the first half of this session, what I'm going to do is invite you to participate in a thought experiment. Okay, so I'm going to get you to do a little bit of thinking because, well, that's how we actually figure anything out. Okay, and at the end of this thought experiment, the conclusion of the thought experiment is going to totally blow your mind. Okay, you're going to have all kinds of questions, and fortunately, we have with us today an expert who will be able to answer all of your questions. So I'm delighted that we have with us today Professor Rob Myers. He's a researcher here at Perimeter Institute, specializing in the area of superstring theory. So let's have a warm welcome for Professor Myers. Okay, so are we ready to enter the black hole and have a mind-warping experience?
Yeah. Yeah!
Okay, so I want to begin with a question, which is, what do we know about our universe? Well, we know a lot, right? Okay, if you were to summarize what we know in just two words, those two words would be quantum and relativity. Okay, so quantum basically told us how it is possible for atoms to exist. Okay, so the quantum nature of our universe, we're going to discuss a little bit more about what that means shortly. But basically, the quantum nature of our universe was discovered by people trying to understand how it is possible for atoms to exist in our universe. Okay, so here is an animation of a modern picture of our atoms. How many of you have seen this kind of a picture of an atom? Electron orbitals in chemistry, that kind of thing. How many of you have seen that? Okay, all of you. So all of you are quantum experts, right? Quantum! Okay. And relativity, on the other hand, okay, relativity basically told us how gravity works. Okay, Newton's model of gravity just told us, you know, the strength of gravity, but it didn't really tell us how it works. The theories of special and general relativity told us how gravity works. So who were those invented by? Yes. Albert Einstein. Right. So Einstein figured out the relativity theories by thinking more deeply about the nature of space, time, and gravity. Okay, this is a modern picture of gravity in action. Okay, so you see a neutron star orbiting around a black hole. The black hole is going to eat this neutron star. So as the neutron star orbits, it gets broken up into smaller and smaller bits, and those bits of matter spiral down, like going down a drain, and they heat up white hot. And just before entering the black hole, they get so hot, they emit a blinding flash of X-rays. It's an amazingly dynamic process. Our universe is a really, really cool place. And we see these sorts of things. This is how we actually detect real black holes. And we would never understand anything like that unless we had a relativistic understanding of the universe given to us by Einstein. Okay, so these two ideas, quantum and relativity, form the foundations of all of our understanding of how the universe works. Okay, so that's really great. The problem is that these two ideas, the quantum and the relativistic nature of the universe, are incompatible. Okay? So quantum, on the one hand, is all about probability. So in the world of in the tiny world of atoms and subatomic particles, we can't actually predict with certainty anything that's going to happen. Okay? It's all about probability and chance. What's the likelihood that this will happen versus that happening? Okay? In relativity, on the other hand, relativity is all about geometry. Okay, so in the world of space, time, and gravity, everything is perfectly predictable, okay, according to very precise laws of geometry. Okay? So, so the, what this leads to is, because they're totally incompatible and very, very different, what this leads to is sort of a multiple, a split personality for the universe. Okay? So a little bit like apples and oranges. Okay? So what we come to here is a very, very deep problem, a very deep question, which has occupied some of the brightest minds in physics for nearly the last century. Okay? And that question is, how is it possible for our universe to even exist? Because on the one hand, we know for sure that the universe obeys quantum laws. Okay? On the other hand, we know that the universe also obeys relativistic laws. Okay? And there are places and times, like inside a black hole, or at the beginning of the universe, the Big Bang, where these two ideas need to work together. They need to mesh together nicely, okay, and tell a coherent kind of story. Okay? We haven't figured out yet exactly how it is these two work together. We know that they do because the universe exists, okay, and in which both of these things are working together, but we don't know exactly how nature does that. Okay, so this is a very, very deep mystery. And so what we really need is a very much deeper understanding of the nature of reality, a deeper understanding from which we can see this split personality as just two sides of the same coin. Okay, so what we need is something that's been called a quantum theory of gravity, or quantum gravity. Okay, so that's the basic idea. That's the basic question of what we're looking for. Okay, and researchers at Perimeter Institute spend a lot of time focusing on exactly that question. So your mission today, should you choose to accept it, dun, 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 is twofold. Okay, so first off, what we want to do is learn everything we need to know about quantum and relativity in 60 seconds. Does that sound doable? Okay. All right. And step number two is, using those ideas about quantum and relativity that we have rolling around in our head, we're going to do a thought experiment. Okay? We're going to think about what those two ideas are trying to tell us about the deeper nature of the universe. It's a really, really exciting just to participate in this process of science, how science really works, especially theoretical physics. Okay, so step one, quantum and relativity in 60 seconds. Okay, first off, quantum. So one of the first and simplest things that we learn about the quantum nature of our universe can be expressed in a really simple formula, E equals hf, okay, which basically tells us that light is a shower of little particles called photons. And each one of those photons has energy, an energy proportional to its frequency, E equals h times f. H is just a constant. So, for example, a blue photon has more energy than a red photon. This is a really cool animation here, showing electrons as little yellow balls, and positive atoms as little blue balls. And when the electrons zip around the atoms, they emit photons, particles of light. Okay, so what you're witnessing here is an animation of the process by which light itself is generated in our universe. Okay, it's really, really cool. These little particles, these little fiery balls are zipping all around like that. Okay, so quantum, light is photons, and those photons have energy. Okay, relativity. So one of the first and simplest things we learn about relativity can also be expressed in a really, really simple formula, and that's E equals mc squared. How many of you have seen that formula? Yeah, okay, everyone. All right. Okay, so basically what that formula says, as you know, is that energy and mass are interchangeable. So energy can be transformed into mass, and mass can be transformed into energy. Okay, this is a cute little animation here showing a particle of matter, the electron, and a particle of antimatter, the anti-electron, combining together, disappearing, and what's appearing in its place is pure energy. So matter, in the form of electron and anti-electron, have disappeared, and what appears is energy, the conversion of mass into energy. Okay, so that's it. So that's quantum relativity. I think that was around 60 seconds, right? So photons, so light is made of photons, photons of energy, and energy and mass are interchangeable. Okay, so those two ideas are going to play a role in our thought experiment here. The third thing, I guess, that we need to know is something that that is sort of obvious, but you might not have thought about it before. Okay? And that is that information is physical. So information is not just this abstract thing. Information must be embodied in one physical form or another. Okay, so I'm going to give you a whole bunch of examples to get that idea in your head, and you'll see what I mean. Okay, so the first example is Einstein. Okay, so Einstein's head was full of all kinds of ideas and thoughts, and you might ask, well, okay, so that's a form of information. So you might ask, well, what kind of concrete form can that take? Well, one form is, you know, Einstein could write down his ideas on a piece of paper. Okay, so that's a piece of paper showing Einstein's ideas about how gravity bends light. Okay, so that's information expressed in some concrete physical form, namely the arrangement of little ink molecules on a piece of paper. Okay, but now you might be wondering, well, what about the thoughts and ideas in his head itself? Okay, how are those represented in some physical form? Well, you all know that the brain is made of neurons, and basically the thoughts and ideas that are rolling around in Einstein's head are basically just a manifestation of the really, really complex interconnections of zillions of neurons, okay, and the electrical impulses that run through those neurons or along those neurons. Okay, so it's a very, very, so information is represented in this complex neural network. Again, it's a physical representation of that information. The information is embodied physically. Okay, so here's another example. Okay, a computer memory. How is it that information is stored in a computer memory? So most of you will know that computers store and process information as long strings of digits, 0 and 1. How many of you are familiar with that idea? Okay, everyone. Fantastic. Okay, so those zeros and ones are not stored in some just abstract way. They're stored in some concrete physical way inside the memory. So for example, when there is no current flowing through a transistor, then that would represent a zero. When there is electrical current flowing through a transistor, that's a one. Electrical current is a physical thing. It's a physical flow of electrons. So whether that flow is there or not, that represents a zero or one. So zero and one are represented in some concrete physical form. Right? Okay, so here's another example. the internet. Okay, so suppose you're downloading something from the internet. Okay, what is actually happening physically in the real world? Okay, well, your computer is connected to this thing called the World Wide Web, the internet, which is this global, this huge network of fiber optic and other links connecting computers all around the world. Okay, so when you're downloading something, somehow a long stream of zeros and ones is entering your computer. But what physical form does that information take? Well, in the case of fiber optic cables, which is a big component of the internet, just as an example, that information is carried in packets of photons, packets of light. Okay, so where there's a packet of photons, that represents a one. Where there's no packet of photons, that represents a zero. Again, information is not this abstract thing. The zeros and ones aren't flowing into your computer in some magical, abstract way. It's concrete. Okay, light is a physical thing with energy is entering or not entering your computer, okay, in little bursts. Okay, so again, information is physical. All right. So what have we figured out so far? Just to sort of set the stage before we begin our thought experiment. So what we know, first of all, from quantum, is that light is made of little particles called photons, and those photons have energy. Okay, the second thing is that we learned from relativity is that energy and a mass are interchangeable. Okay, and we'll see this coming up in our thought experiment. And the third thing, just a general sense about the world we live in, is that information needs to be embodied in one physical form or another. For example, information on the internet is carried by light, which has energy. It's a physical entity. Okay, so now we're ready to begin our thought experiment. Are we ready to go? Okay, here we go. So what are quantum and relativity trying to tell us about the deeper nature of reality? Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to focus our attention on the space inside this sphere. And associated with that space, we're going to ask a pretty basic sounding question, but it will have a really interesting answer. The question we're going to focus on is, how much information can we cram inside that sphere? Okay, keeping in mind that information is physical and the two things we know about quantum and relativity. Okay, so here we go.
So how, what is the maximum information we can jam in there? So information, so I hope that by now you're convinced of the idea that information in any form can be represented as a long string of zeros and ones, just to keep things as simple as possible. For example, I mean, the information highway, the internet, that's how all the information travels. Okay, so are we okay with that? All right, so information is a long string of zeros and ones, and we want to stick that into that sphere. Okay, but we can't stick it in just some abstract sort of way. It's not just sort of this mathematical thing. We need to physically put the information in there in some physical form. And so it turns out that one of the simplest ways to do that is to embody the information in photons, particles of light. Okay, so the reason is, it turns out that photons, when they're traveling, they can be rotating right, which we can use to say, oh, that's a one. Or they can be rotating left, which we can use to say, well, that's a zero. So we can represent a zero and a one in just the two different ways that a photon can be spinning as it travels. Okay, so photons are really convenient for embodying that information. So physically, we're going to be sending a beam of particles, photons, into that sphere. Okay, that's how we're jamming the information in. And one photon is going to represent one bit of information. A bit is a zero or a one, whether the photon is spinning right or left. Okay, and we're going to stick all those photons in there, and they're going to store, and that sphere is going to store that information. Okay, so we're okay so far? All right. Okay, now we come to the lesson from quantum, which is that each one of those photons has energy. Okay, and energy E equals HF. So every time we put a bit of information into the sphere, we're putting a bit of energy into the sphere. Okay, so more information means more energy. And now we turn to the lesson from relativity, which is that energy and mass are interchangeable, okay? At least certainly as far as gravity is concerned. Okay, so a ball of energy will attract gravitationally a nearby object or warp space, according to Einstein, in the same way that a ball of mass. So energy and mass are just interchangeable in that respect. Energy attracts matter in the same as matter, in the same way that matter attracts matter. Okay, so that sphere full of energy is effectively a sphere full of mass in terms of its gravitational effect. Okay, so basically, the more information that we jam into that sphere, effectively, the more mass we've jammed into that sphere. Okay, so our original question about how much information can we jam into that sphere is the same question as, is there a maximum amount of mass that we could jam into some region of space like this? Okay, so if I have some region of space and I start jamming mass into it, more and more and more and more, is there some limit? Is something strange going to happen if I put too much mass into a small space, into a given space?
Black hole. Right, exactly. So what's going to happen, of course, at the end of the day, if we put in too much mass, we're going to get a black hole. So the black hole is the limit to the amount of information you can put inside. And down on the right there, you see a little formula which relates the size of the sphere, that R there is the radius of the sphere, to the mass. So that formula gives you the mass that you would have to jam into a sphere of radius R to form a black hole. Okay, C there is the speed of light, and G is, what's G? Newton's constant, exactly. Okay, so, so there it is. So it turns out that if you combine the three formulas that you've seen, the E equals HF and the E equals MC squared, and that last formula relating the radius of the black hole to the mass, you combine those three formulas together in a clever way, which I'm going to leave as an exercise for you to do tonight, right? Okay, it's a really, really cool thing. Should you really try to do this? Okay, what you will really discover is something really, really remarkable. Okay, and this is the result of our thought experiment, which I'm going to talk about. You're going to discover that the amount of information, the number of bits that you can cram into a sphere of a given area, is actually proportional to the area. Okay, so the area of the sphere divided by 4a. So what is that funny looking a? That funny looking a is called the Planck area. Okay, so it turns out that there's a natural unit of area in nature. Okay, so it's not the square meter. Okay, when nature measures, when nature asks what is the area of some surface, nature doesn't ask how many square meters. of surface area there are, nature asks how many Planck units of area there are. So the Planck unit of area is a very, very tiny unit of area. It's a natural unit of area that comes from relativity and quantum. Okay, and that unit of area is very, very much smaller than the square meter, the natural unit of area for humans. It turns out to be 10 to the minus 66 square meters, so extremely tiny. Okay, so basically, the number of bits of information is, if you ignore the factor of 4 there, it's the area of the sphere measured in Planck units of area. How many of those little tiny Planck units of area will fit around? Okay, so what I want to focus on is this result is extremely bizarre for two reasons. Okay, but the first reason is that the maximum information is finite. If we didn't think of information as physical, if we thought of it as just this these abstract numbers or whatever, well, there would be no limit to how many numbers, abstract numbers, we could put in the sphere. But once we realize that information is physical, has energy, and that energy warps the space and so on, everything becomes physical, and you realize that there is, in fact, it's finite. Okay? Now let's ask, is it a large amount? Let's just get a feeling for how much information. So if I had a sphere about this big, the surface area is about 1 square meter. So if I take that formula and say take 1 square meter, forget the factor of 4, take 1 square meter divided by the Planck area, 1 divided by 10 to the minus 66 is what?
+66.
10 to the plus 66. Okay, so it's saying that a sphere this big can hold 10 to the 66 bits of information. Does that seem like a little or a lot? Or a lot? Okay. It's actually, yeah, there's a lot. Okay, so the other day I did just a little calculation, and I figured out that using current technology, computer technology, memory chips or whatever, we could fit probably in an area, in a sphere this size, we could jam in there about 10 to the 20 bits. Okay? Whereas in theory, we could, in principle, before black hole forms, fit 10 to the 66 bits in there. The difference is huge. That's 46 orders of magnitude. 10 times 10 times 10, 46 times. So what that tells us is that our technology is super primitive compared to what is potentially possible or theoretically possible in our universe. Okay, so we've got a long way to go. We're encouraged by this, right? We have lots of room to grow here. Okay, so it's finite. And the second and much more bizarre thing about this result is that the amount of information, the maximum amount, depends upon the surface area of the sphere and not its volume. Okay, that is the really mind-blowing thing. Okay, so to see that, let's talk about that a little bit more. All right, so it turns out that idea may be one of the deepest hints that we have about the real deep nature of reality. So it might be and it might not be. We don't know. Okay? That's the idea of science, is these are unanswered questions. We're like into the frontiers of knowledge here. Okay? But I want you to notice how what a simple kind of thought experiment has taken us right to these frontiers. It's really, really cool. Okay, so let's just re-examine what it is we've done here. So we've got this sphere. And the idea is that as we fill that sphere with information, we're going to reach a maximum, at which point a black hole forms. And the maximum is the area measured in Planck units of area. Okay? And so there's a sphere which shows, so we've got a surface of a sphere, and if we divide that sphere those little red triangles there, if we divide that sphere into little triangles of a Planck unit of area, and for every 4 of those Planck units of area, the little blue triangle there, you can put 1 bit of information into that sphere. So the idea here is that we're actually filling the volume of the sphere with information. Okay, we're firing photons in there, which each represent a bit of information. We're filling the volume with information. And yet the answer we get for the maximum amount of information is the same as if we were just to consider the surface area of that sphere, draw little triangles on it, and paint zeros and ones, and fill up the information just on the surface of that sphere, with totally disregarding the volume inside. Okay, this is really, really quite bizarre. Okay, so just think about it for a second here. First of all, this is much less information than you might have expected. information is essentially the same amount as the information for a reality living on just the surface surrounding that volume. And this is very, very bizarre. All right. So this leads us to the question of our session here. Our world is a hologram. Okay, so let me just draw a connection between what we've been talking about and the basic idea of a hologram. How do you know what a hologram is? You've seen holograms. A couple of you? Maybe on credit cards, that kind of thing? Yeah, Star Trek, that sort of thing? OK. So, so this is a two-dimensional hologram. It doesn't look like much. It's actually an interference pattern of light. Okay, so you would have some object over here, you illuminate with laser light, and you take another part of the beam and you illuminate the film and so on. And you get some interference pattern of light. So it doesn't look like much. It's just this wavy pattern there. Until you illuminate it with laser light. And then you discover something amazing. You discover that it contains three-dimensional information. In the sense that what crops out is this full three-dimensional image. Okay, so if I look at that two-dimensional surface illuminated with laser light, let's say from the left, what I'm going to see is a three-dimensional image of some guy's head, say, the right side of his face. Okay, if I now turn to the other side and look at it from another angle, I will see the other side of his face. So and as I move my head around, I see that, wow, that two-dimensional surface contains full three-dimensional information. Okay? So in a sense, he's in that two-dimensional surface. Okay? So that two-dimensional surface contains three-dimensional information. Okay? In exactly the same way as with our sphere. Our sphere has information jammed into that three-dimensional space. And yet it's equivalent to having just painted that information on the two-dimensional surface. Okay? So the idea is very much like a hologram. Hence the question, is our world possibly in some way, which we don't understand yet, like maybe like a hologram? Okay, it's really, really bizarre. Right? So here's the, let me just put it as a picture here. So this is a picture of a woman living in a two-dimensional flat world, okay, like our two-dimensional hologram here. And yet she has this illusion that she is this three-dimensional being, okay, just like our three-dimensional guy there. Okay, so it, you know, is the world in some way like that, in some way which we don't yet understand? Okay, so I just have a quote here from Jacob Bekenstein, who is one of the big names associated with this idea, in which he says, our everyday perceptions of the world as three-dimensional would then be either a profound illusion or merely one of two alternative ways of viewing reality. Okay, that is really, really cool. Okay, that's one of the possibly one of the hints at the deeper nature of reality. All right, so basically, we're at the point where now, what do you think about all of this? Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to turn ourselves over here to the question period. So we're going to invite Professor Myers up here, and we're just going to exchange microphones here, and Rob is going to answer all of your questions. All right, so here we go.
And I should say he provided me with a class list here and said that if I don't get any questions, I'm supposed to start quizzing you. And given that you all know about special relativity or E equals mc squared, that's a pretty high level where the quiz starts. So. Yeah.
All right. So we're looking at a 2D image, right? That model of the black hole where you're just painting things on the outside. Sure. Are you looking at it as though that could be the universe, as though our universe is a bubble, and we're on the very outside, and there's no volume on the inside?
Well, that would. I'm very much in favor of the second of those alternatives given by Jacob Bekenstein, and so. There is this special surface at the surface of the black hole known as the event horizon. And what the information that you're really capturing there, though, isn't the entire universe, isn't the stuff outside, it's really the stuff that you were trying to cram inside. And so the idea is that the information can either be organized as, you know, information on the surface of the black hole, Or you can think of it as three-dimensional beings or three-dimensional information that lives inside that surface or inside the black hole.
So, in a sense, there could possibly be another universe inside a black hole.
That's actually a very deep question interpreted in a certain way, but I would say that it's the same universe. I mean, it's the, you know, how do you form a black hole? You take a star, you take a bunch of matter, and you compress it, and then at a certain point, the gravitational force takes over, and everything just collapses and continues to collapse. If you're riding along on the surface of that star, you know, your reality or your perceptions of reality don't change. You still think of it as, you know, the world is a three-dimensional world, although we're riding along in this catastrophic collapse now. So it's a very dramatic world that we live in. But on the other hand, from the point of view of the theoretical physicist, the idea is that I can reorganize that story, reorganize that information, and portray it entirely in terms of information or a story that lives in a set of degrees of freedom or just lives on this surface of the black hole, this two-dimensional surface. So you should moderate. I don't know where to.
Okay, there's a facility called CERN in Switzerland.
Yes.
I would like to know that what are they trying to achieve over there?
Okay. So that's a little bit away from what we're talking about today, but basically, well, perhaps it speaks to a point I wanted to make, that what Richard introduced was this idea of a Planck area, or if I take the square root of an area, it tells me about a distance scale. And that distance scale was 10 to the minus 33 meters. And so that's a scale that we can imagine. On the other hand, you know, in reality, we use technology and we're trying to understand nature, and so we're probing nature to smaller and smaller scales. And basically, the LHC, or the Large Hadron Collider, is right now the ultimate probe or the ultimate microscope that we have. And so we're trying to probe nature or the fundamental constituents of nature at a scale there of about 10 to the minus 18 meters. So these, again, are numbers with big exponents, but you can see there's a big discrepancy where technology brings us today and where the thought experiments or where our mind can take us in these experiments. But basically the role of the LHC is it's the next step in you know, man's quest to understand nature or the fundamental constituents of nature at a smaller and smaller scale. Does that answer the question?
Yeah.
Or, yeah, okay. Sure.
Yeah, we know that like black hole sucks in packets of energy, right?
Yeah.
And is there a radiation that gets, like, light is radiation too, right? So if there's radiation that can get out of black hole, right, it can be used as a source of power, the energy.
So, well, there's an interesting set of ideas there. Einstein's black holes, I mean, Einstein wrote down a beautiful theory of gravity, and as Richard was saying, it's a theory in which the space and or the geometry of space and time become dynamical and warp, and you form these black holes. But in his conception of a black hole, stuff goes in, but nothing comes out. Now, part of the inconsistency that Richard mentioned was when you bring in the ideas of quantum. And quantum says that sometimes processes that aren't allowed or that we think aren't allowed by you know, the classical ideas of physics or the old ideas of physics can occur. And so what Stephen Hawking discovered was that when I take into account quantum effects, that in fact a little bit of radiation is always tunneling out or leaking out of the black hole. And so if you do get a certain amount of radiation that does come out, but it's not very useful energy. in that if I assign a temperature to it, or an energy scale to those photons, it's a very, very small temperature, or a very, very small amount of energy per packet or per photon.
But then it will have much faster speed than light, right, for it to escape from a black hole.
You might say that, but that's sort of the quantum nature. I said that it leaks or it tunnels out. It does something that ordinarily, when I write down Einstein's special relativity, you know, the rules that he wrote down dictate that nothing can get out. But what's leaking out is just ordinary light, but it's going through in a quantum process that's allowing it to escape. So it's if you like, a small fluctuation away from Einstein's rules, that it can disobey those rules for just an instant, and that lets it suddenly leak out just very, very slowly.
Okay, well, that segues nicely to my question. Let's speak of Newtonian gravity for a second, because that's the easiest way to explain it. But in a black hole, light can't escape because the force of gravity is way too strong, right?
Okay.
So that must imply that there's a force that would be decelerating objects at the speed of light, if not faster, correct? In a sense.
There is a very strong force. I'm not exactly sure how, when I put those words together, but there's a very, very strong force, yes.
But then, like, the theory of relativity says there's a connection between high speed and time, right?
Yeah.
So if light can't escape, that means time's probably not moving, because once you hit the speed of light, or if you go over the speed of light, you get a negative number, right? That means you go back in time. So I'm assuming that once you hit the speed of light, time stops moving. So I'm thinking that inside a black hole, time's not moving. So from the outside, how we perceive that, would that just be the black hole never goes away?
Well, there's an interesting set of words put together there. It's certainly true that, as I said, that in Einstein's theory, the first thing that Einstein told us with general relativity is that space and time are connected, and they're, you know, I shouldn't think of them as separate. You know, even though you measure space or distances with rulers, and it seems we have a completely different way of measuring time, what he told us was that the speed of light is a conversion constant that lets us convert between intervals of time and intervals of space. Like if I give you 1 second, what I do is I multiply by the speed of light, and that's nature's conversion constant that turns it into a distance scale. Now, in general relativity, everything became dynamical and the space becomes twisted up. And it's certainly true that when I go inside the black hole, that we say things like the role of space and time are changed. So for instance, if I'm an observer outside, when I try and create photons, I can only create photons that have positive energies. This is related to going backwards in time and getting negative numbers. When I go inside, it turns out that in fact photons can have positive or negative energies. And it's the fact that the energies can be negative that's related again to this, the fact that in a quantum sense, or those photons can escape because of the unusual properties of the photons in the presence of the black hole. I'll go one more time to you, okay, but we gotta let some other people.
There's small particles that hit the surface of Earth, right? And it produces cosmic rays.
Well, the cosmic rays are small particles hitting the Earth, yes.
So that creates a black hole, right?
So in principle, one might say that if I have a very, very high speed particle, it's carrying a lot of energy, I smash it into something, say at the surface of the Earth. Now, before you had a lot of energy, but it was basically the kinetic energy, you know, that was carrying the particle along. If you stop it suddenly that all of that energy is concentrated there. You might think that I can form a black hole. And so in principle, in a thought experiment, that's possible. But in reality, our everyday experience of observing these cosmic rays is that we have yet to see a black hole form. And so it seems, in principle, it's a possibility. It's not something that we've ever observed.
Why are we doing the particles later if we know that it's not going to produce a black hole?
Well, I'm not necessarily, okay, so if I'm going to the LHC, there's certainly an interest, there's a certain set of theories which say it may be possible to build black holes or to form black holes, but those are going to be unusual theories. I mean, remember I was talking about the distance scale that we're probing there was 10 to the minus 18 meters, whereas the black holes are naturally associated with this distance scale 10 to the minus 33. So I have to rearrange the rules of the game if I'm going to get black holes forming at 10 to the minus 18. On the other hand, theorists are very creative, and so we've come up with scenarios or theories where that is a possibility. But really, the reason you build a huge experiment like that is not to go after exotic theories like that, but rather to understand more ideas that are perhaps less exotic or less from the edges of quantum gravity or from the edges of the boundaries of our thought. They're trying to search for one of the buzzwords is the Higgs particle. The Higgs particle is, in some sense, a missing piece in the puzzle. Right now we have, our understanding of particles and interactions in nature is described by something called the Standard Model of Particle Physics. And it does an amazing job, and it can make remarkable predictions about all sorts of experiments. But there's this one piece of the puzzle called the Higgs particle, or it's something in the catalog of all the different constituents that we've never seen. And so we're not sure if that's really a piece, if we really have the right picture, if that's really a piece of the puzzle, or if nature is more creative or more inventive than the theorists have been, and that there's some other mechanism or there's some other way that the puzzle gets completed. And so what they're really trying to understand, one of the key projects is to understand this Higgs particle or the origin of mass.
It's not producing that.
Well, that since the theorists come up with these remarkable ideas, they put that into the program and say, well, we're looking for the Higgs, let's look for black holes at the same time. But when you're originally building the experiment, they design it, they optimize it to look for this other, the main part of the program is something else, some other piece of physics. Let's go somewhere else here.
I know we can sort of predict what will happen to an object as opposed to the event horizon, but are we able to predict what would happen once it reached the singularity?
Well, that's the bottom line is no. That's one of the remarkable things about Einstein's theory of gravity. What we find in looking at, the simplest solution, it's a solution that describes a black hole. It was written down by a fellow called Schwarzschild, 2 years after the theory was invented. But what you find in that solution is that things go crazy. The forces diverge. There are infinities in your equation. And so what that's telling us is that you can use Einstein's theory to describe a lot of that space-time, a lot of that geometry. But the theory essentially is predicting its own downfall, because it's saying there are spaces, there are going to be extreme regions where the equations are just going to break down. And so that's a part of the quest in quantum gravity, is to understand, how is nature or how is physics going to continue past that point, or how are we going to resolve those infinities and understand what's really happening there. How about you? No, you.
And he said that still there are some photons tunneling the magnet. That means that from early on there are still photons leaking, and they are just ordinary photons. That means that we are getting no information from them. Like, this means that really the information, there's no information on them, like, it doesn't supposed to be like that. Like, every single thing should give us information, like, every single photon should give us information. But if they are ordinary photons, they mean that they are providing no information to us.
That's why I think you're hitting at an idea. I mean, what Richard already described is that any photon, in some sense, carries information. And one way is through its polarization or the way it's spinning. Another way is through its energy or the fact that it's there as opposed to not being there. So any photon can carry information, and it carries it in different ways. If you have a whole collection of photons, in principle, there's lots of information that's there. But that really hints to the, you know, this inconsistency again. If I take something that we understand like a star, you know, we can describe that star. We have no problems writing down the information on a piece of paper that, you know, describes exactly how it behaves and its dynamics. Now I crush that into a black hole, and the black hole starts to leak energy into these photons. Well, if it's leaking energy into the photon, the black hole is becoming smaller. It's losing mass. That was one of our relations. And so eventually, if it leaks long enough, all I have left are the photons and no black hole, because I've used up all the energy. But then what puzzles the theoretical physicist is, well, I should, given those photons, be able to have the information to run the whole process backwards to understand exactly where those photons came from. They shouldn't, you know, they should somehow have imprinted in them the information that I wrote down originally about, you know, the details of the star that went in to form the black hole, how long the black hole was around, and how it evaporated. And so there are going to be some gross features that you know are obvious, you know, like the total mass of the system is going to be the same at the beginning and the end. But the detailed information, that's really the key puzzle. We don't know how to extract or how to translate the information or, you know, the details of the photons that are left behind into a quantitative story about the black hole and how it formed and all of that.
So this means that there is some information on those photons that are coming out of black hole.
We certainly, most physicists believe that the information is there and that it's encoded, if you like, in a very complicated way. You know, if we calculate how many photons there are, we start getting huge numbers, like the numbers that Richard was throwing around at the end of his talk. And so there's a lot of bits, but we don't know what the code is, how to translate those bits, all of that, you know, those zeros and ones into a really consistent story about how that black hole formed or what that star was that went into it. So
is it possible that we're missing like a big idea comparable to like quantum? Like, is it possible that we're missing a big theory like that?
It certainly is. It could be that there is the new idea, the you know, we'll be talking in 100 years about Schmaltz theory. I don't know what it is. But it could be that, you know, we kind of got a good grasp here. Quantum really works well in a lot of situations. We've got a good grasp of general relativity that describes marvelously a lot of other different physical situations. What we're looking at now with our thought experiments is a domain where those two theories come into conflict. And that's typically, you know, the kind of situation that we saw in the 20th century when, you know, really good theories that each, you know, served us well in various domains, when they came together in a common domain, we saw inconsistencies or or conflicts, and it was in resolving those inconsistencies that you know, really allowed theoretical physics to advance and produce new ideas. And so what Richard said, that I'm a superstring theorist, and you know, superstring theory in some sense is one of our conjectures or one of the ideas that's out there that we're trying to use to put together the quantum and the relativity in a new structure. And so maybe it'll be string theory, maybe it'll be Schmaltz theory, maybe it'll be one of you that finds that new idea.
Now, in the presentation, you guys use a sphere for an example that photons are actually stored on the outside surface area of the sphere, but not the volume. Now, why did you guys use a sphere? Could you guys use a square, a cube, or could you guys use an amoeba-like structure or shape? Why is it a sphere?
The sphere is just the simplest thing to start to work with. I mean, it's got a single length scale, the radius that characterizes how big the sphere is. You could just as easily do these things with cubes or rectangles or prisms. Technically, it's you're just asking to make the calculations a little bit more complicated. When you go to the amoeba, it would become even more complicated. But just to illustrate the purpose or to illustrate the ideas, you know, the sphere was the simplest thing to present the idea with. Okay.
No one else.
Sure.
Did someone else have a question?
Oh, there is. Oh, I'm sorry.
So when you say there's radiation coming out of the black holes, and I also saw in the presentation that when a neutron star gets into a black hole, there's extra radiation emitted. So is it possible that there's probability that only there's a certain frequency, the photon that has that frequency is the only photon that's able to escape the gravitational force?
Okay, so the first thing I should separate is the radiation that leaks out, or the Hawking radiation, as it's often called, and the X-rays. Perhaps this goes back to an earlier question when we were talking about black holes and producing energy with black holes. One of the things that you're seeing with the X-rays is that they are very energetic objects. But what you're seeing is that we're taking the gravitational potential energy, if I can say those words. I mean, there's a lot of, if I start a long distance away from the black hole, I fall towards the black hole, I pick up a huge amount of kinetic energy. And so when I see those X-rays, that's purely a process that's described by the ordinary rules of relativity that Einstein. And basically what you're doing is you're starting here with potential energy, gravitational potential energy, it gets converted to kinetic energy, and then that gets turned into these X-rays. And it is an extremely energetic process, and so these X-rays are actually very high energy photons. When we think of the Hawking radiation, what I said is that the energies involved are, in fact, tiny. They're orders and orders of magnitude smaller than those X-rays. They're smaller than, you know, if I assign a temperature to them, they're smaller than, typically they're smaller than the smallest temperature we can achieve in experiments in a laboratory. And so it's really a completely different kind of process, and it's part of what makes this a thought experiment, because you know, in reality I have black holes and they're surrounded by matter falling in producing X-rays and high energy photons. I'm never going to be able to see these low energy Hawking quanta that I believe are slowly leaking out because of all this other you know, exciting stuff that's happening in, around the black hole. But when I think about the way we understand the Hawking tunneling, those photons have low energies. There's a characteristic scale, the wavelength, which is basically about the size of the black hole, because the black hole naturally has a size, and so it imprints that. But it does it in a very loose way. There's a whole spectrum of different photons. Most of them come out around that, but there are many that are, or there are a few that are longer wavelengths, there are a few that are shorter wavelengths. It's really a distribution. We don't think that it's a single discrete frequency or wavelength that comes out.
So most of them would be around the same spectrum, but they don't all.
Yeah, it's actually what you get is that if I was counting the photons and I had here their wavelengths, I get some kind of a distribution, and there's a favored, there's a maximum, and so that wavelength around here would be about the size of the black hole, but you can see that it's a very wide distribution. You're getting all sorts of different kinds of photons at different wavelengths.
Okay, so I think we're nearly out of time. We have maybe time for one more question. So, go ahead, you have your hand up.
My question is that since we have like 11 dimensions in the universe, right, and three on Earth, so many of the last break apart inside the black hole. So, is it possible that we would have no dimensions inside the black hole?
First of all, okay, so we have 11 dimensions. That's actually an interesting observation that we must have found in the popular literature somewhere. Many of, when I think about string theory, there, in some sense, I understand many different phases of string theory. Sometimes space-time looks like it's 11-dimensional. Sometimes it looks like it's 10-dimensional. And so perhaps that's a reflection of this kind of holography that we're talking about, that if I reorganize the theory, the dimension of the space-time changes. In general, though, what we observe around us is 3 plus 1, 1 being the time. And so a large part of string theory, an essential part of string theory is that, I have to curl up or get rid of make them very small, these extra dimensions, so that I don't see them. One of the things that I'd like to emphasize, though, if I'm talking about string theory, is that that's really an essential feature of the theory, that if I didn't have those extra dimensions, then the theory wouldn't really be rich enough to describe our world. It's in curling up that extra geometry that there's all sorts of different physics, all sorts of different, or the richness, the potential possibilities for our three-dimensional world really arise from engineering those extra dimensions. And so it's a different, It's again a different way of thinking about the theory, putting new physics into geometry again, very much in the spirit of Einstein's theory. But I should go to the heart of your question, which was, what happens at the space-time singularity? It could be that there are any number of possibilities. We really don't know. It could be, in some sense, that the meaning of space-time just disintegrates, and so in some sense you would be right that we shouldn't think in terms of 3 plus 1 or 10 or 11, that there's some other kind of fuzz or quantum reality that arises at the singularity. Another one, given that we're talking about theories with 10 and 11 dimensions, whereas we're perceiving only 3 plus 1, it could be that those extra dimensions open up and that reality actually, you know, the perceptions of someone falling in, actually one starts to see extra dimensions rather than fewer dimensions. But the bottom line is that's, you know, one of the puzzles that we're after. We really don't know what's happening at that singularity.
Okay, so unfortunately, I think we're out of time. So let's thank Professor Myers for being on. Thank you for all your wonderful questions. That's what makes science exciting. There are lots of frontiers, lots of unknowns. And I just want to welcome you to come back to next time's Black Hole Science Cafe. And in the meantime, I'd like you to also invite you to visit Perimeter Institute's website, which has all kinds of great content. There are public lectures on a variety of topics, including this topic and a whole bunch of other topics at the frontiers of knowledge. And there's also articles on what we research and all kinds of other resources there to meet. So check out the website in the meantime. And until next time, thanks for joining us. Thank you.